Hi everyone, thanks for coming to the Lowy Institute today and welcome to our event, which we've entitled A New Politics, Discussing Sectarianism and Civil Society in Indonesia. I'm Matthew Bush and I'm a research fellow here at the Lowy Institute, and I'd like to extend a special welcome to our two esteemed guests all the way from Jakarta, Sandra Hamid and Ima Abdul Rahman. I'd also like to pay a special thanks to the Australia-Indonesia Institute and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, who supported this project and made it possible for Sandra and Ima to come to Australia and share their expertise with the Australian community. In addition to this event today, we're really putting them through the ringer. We're holding public events and roundtables in Melbourne and Canberra, and Sandra and Ima are both appearing in the Australian media, as well as, from what I understand, catching up with family and friends. So thank you to the Australia-Indonesia Institute. So I wrote the grant for this project about a year ago, and it was right after the second round of the Jakarta election when former education minister and Paramedina University rector Anies Baswedan, who is now governor, had defeated Basuki Ahok Purnama, who was then shortly sentenced to 2 years in prison for blasphemy. And the election, as many of you will know, had been preceded by mass protests and largely by Islamic organizations of a sort of scale that hadn't been seen in Jakarta since 1998, when President Suharto fell from power. And so at the time, many predicted that the rise of sectarian politics and mass Islamic mobilizations that were used to attack Ahok would become the sort of new primary feature of a rougher and more confrontational and less democratic Indonesian politics. The obvious goal for the coalition in the future was going to be the unseating of President Joko Widodo in the 2019 elections. And this may still happen, and we're going to discuss this a bit today. But it's hard to feel as if a lot of things haven't already changed in Indonesia, which often happens, actually, I should say, and probably aren't as simple as they appeared. The coalition of interests and actors that combined so dramatically to oppose Ahok has proved far from durable, partially because of organic reasons, but also because of the pressure of the state. And the president, who I think a lot of people saw as a pluralist, squarely in the pluralist camp, has actually been far more authoritarian in some of his political preferences than we would have thought. So a lot has changed, and we would also be remiss to not dwell and talk a bit about last week's terrible and unusually tragic attacks in Surabaya and Jakarta. As it seems, Indonesia unfortunately has to contend again with the scourge of terrorism. This also is, of course, a political year in Indonesia, 2018. We think a lot about the 2019 elections, but Indonesia is having more than 160 subnational elections next month. And so I think this also is a very timely opportunity to discuss some of the tactics and trends that we might see heading into next year's big political year. And so in light of all of these things, we're very fortunate to have such eminent visitors, who are two of Indonesia's leading experts on religion and politics, as well as democratic governance and human rights. I'll give a brief introduction of both of you, and then we'll go into our discussion. So starting with Sandra, immediately to my left, Sandra Hamid is the country representative in Indonesia for the Asia Foundation, among the Asia Pacific's leading international development organizations. She is a trained cultural anthropologist with a strong interest in political participation and civil society. At the foundation, she has designed and implemented programs on political participation, knowledge and policy, governance, gender, and religious freedom. She has worked as a program manager in both the foundation's Jakarta and Aceh offices, and previously, she was a writer, researcher, and international development consultant with experience in Indonesia, Timor-Leste, and the United States. She served in PAN, the National Mandate Party, which was formed shortly after President Suharto's 1998 resignation. She's a former Fulbright Scholar, Draper Hill Summer Fellow on Democracy and Development at Stanford University, and two-time recipient of the Asia Foundation's Presidential Award for Exceptional Performance. Sandra has a PhD in anthropology from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. To her left is Ima Abdulrahim. Ima is the executive director and runs the day-to-day operations of the Habibie Center, which is an Indonesian think tank focused on democracy and human rights. She's a prominent advocate for peace policy and Indonesian democracy, and she speaks regularly both in Indonesia and abroad about Indonesia's role in ASEAN, global governance, and Southeast Asia's democratization. In 2015, she was selected as a 2015 Yale World Fellow, and in 2010, she completed an Ideas Indonesia Fellowship through the MIT Sloan School of Management. In 2001, she was awarded the Asia Foundation's APSA Congressional Fellowship, and she worked for a California congresswoman. She has a Bachelor of Human Science in Political Science and Islamic Revealed Knowledge and Heritage from the International Islamic University in Malaysia. She also has a Master's of International Studies from SOAS. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming to Australia. Welcome to Sydney. First things first, I think because most of our audience, the most recent thing they'll have heard about from Indonesia is the attacks last week, which have included grim firsts such as the first family suicide bombing. Terrorism in recent years in Indonesia has been really marginalized, actually, and confined to relatively poorly coordinated attacks, mostly on the police. Do the recent attacks, which did include the police, as well as three churches, do you think this represents a departure from the equilibrium that we've seen in recent years, probably since 2009, when there were hotel bombings in Jakarta? Do you think this is a change in terrorism in Indonesia, or just sort of a one-off? Sandra?
Okay. Hello. I want to thank Louis first, though, for bringing an all-female panel. Ima has been on the forefront of fighting all male panels in Indonesia, and it's actually not easy to actually find women speaker. Apparently, they always say there's no women who would be willing to speak. So most panels in Indonesia, you find all male panels. And so thank you, Louis, for bringing all female panel. You can check that list, Ima, because otherwise she will post it.
Yeah.
And she
will. Well, so to prevent people like Ima from getting at us on social media, we have a policy about no all male panels. So
Yes.
But that is not actually not why I put this panel together. I mean what I said about the sort of two experts on religion and politics and civil society. So
you were
my first two choices when I wrote the grant, and I'm lucky to have gotten you.
Thank you. So Surabaya, it was really, really grim, right? It was also there's a lot of first in that, you know, and the first that came to mind is the fact that it was actually orchestrated by a family, and a family who actually included very young children to actually be involved in killing. And so a lot of the rhetoric in Indonesia following that was the first one was actually focusing on that. And after that is the question as to, is this a new strategy? And I think Sidney Jones, which is the prominent authority, right, on terrorism, basically said this is really going to be the difference of many different things that we're going to have to think about in the future, is the new strategy of ISIS, that ISIS has always been about family affair, to quote Sidney Jones. And so it is not surprising to her that this whole family strategy is actually being taken up by the perpetrators. What we need to be thinking about going forward is exactly your question. Is it actually tipping the equilibrium, right? And I think that is a question of what are the responses that we have as a country, as well as the, you know, government, as well as civil society. What are actually the rhetorics that are actually responding to this? Because I think we can go all the way to almost tyrannical responses to what we think as anything that has to do with terrorism, and that would also include the whole gradation of extremism, radicalism, or merely just intolerant? Are we actually going that way? Or are we actually going to be more nuanced in our responses to this threat? People who actually work on terrorism, and I'd like to note that I am not a terrorism expert, and I would warn you, there's a lot of all of a sudden terrorism expert now in the media, everywhere. All of a sudden people become, you know, expert on terrorism. I would say I am not an expert on terrorism. But I think quoting people who actually know about this, they actually warn us that this is actually not going to be the last. We have to be vigilant. We have to be careful that this is actually a beginning of something that is actually going to be different. And following, as you said, a political year in Indonesia, 1928, the more than 100 elections going forward, and the presidential election. This, and not to forget also international events that are actually going to take place in Indonesia. ASEAN Games is actually scheduled this year, and also a IMF and World Bank event in Bali. So with all of these international things going on in the country, it is only expected that the energy from the other side, i.e. ISIL and people who are actually going to create havoc, well, the incentive for them is actually higher to do things in the next couple of years.
So, Ima, what do you think? I mean, do you think this is, because we touched a bit on intolerance there, and intolerance links to this phenomenon of sectarianism in Indonesia, do you think that this is it fair to say this is sort of the flip side of a sort of rougher and more confrontational and more exclusivist politics? Or are these things sort of not related, and we shouldn't sort of link them, or we should be very cautious about linking them? And then, as a consequence of that, people have used this to try and sort of criticize the government and sort of make this political and say, oh, well, this is because Jokowi is a weak leader. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be effective? Are these things related? I mean, that seems like sort of a cheap political attack, but is there sort of a politicians being willing to sort of permit intolerance for political purposes? Do we think that these things are related?
Yeah, I think the last one that you mentioned, that we have to really be careful in linking the terrorist attacks and intolerance. And one of the things that that I said, you know, just as the attacks happened, was we have to really be careful in identifying. We have to be really careful in who we're, what we're, I mean, who we're pinning this on. The international media was very quick to say, has ISIS landed in Indonesia? Is this an external factor? Is this, again, the conspiracy theories, of course, started coming, pouring through and all of that. And of course, we don't like to prescribe to them, but one of the things that I think is and you mentioned intolerance, this is what troubled Indonesians the most. The conversations that happened right after the attack wasn't about external factors, wasn't about ISIS, wasn't about politics. It was more humanity. It was like, how can you now tolerate, how can you think that blowing up other people is an expression of your religion? So there was the conversations were around that. Then of course, as we found out that it was a family, you know, it came out, like, especially for those who, during the, because you mentioned the AHO campaign, you know, elections and all of that, and rising intolerance and groups. And so people who were, you know, part of the mass rallies that you mentioned earlier, they actually tried to say, no, this is not what we're about. This is not where we're not leaning towards violence. Right. And I think that was what was important. And also, by not by focusing so much on what are the external factors and what is causing these attacks, or whether it's an ideological thing, whether it's ISIS linked, or whether it's ideologically linked to ISIS, we then forget to look within the communities how fragile Indonesian society is in terms of receiving this type of information. Because again, it was very, very quick for people to blame the Jokowi administration and turn it into politics. It was very quick to turn the bombings into something. Oh, this is because the parliament hasn't passed the bill. Oh, this is because Jokowi is a weak leader. Oh, this is because the police aren't trustworthy. This was, them not doing their job. How can they this pass their, how can the intelligence miss this and all of that? So it was very quick to blame it on governance and move politics into it. But at the end of the day, I think we need to remember that, yes, I mean, the rising intolerance and the fact that there were groups that actually thought this was okay, that these, oh, it's just another bombing, and there were groups that actually, it's like, the fake news and all, whatever happens in the world right now about fake news, it happens in Indonesia as well. Some people, said this was staged. So it's very important for Indonesia and for Indonesians and for the international community to also understand that it's dangerous to link them directly. So I think there's a lot of factors that we don't know still. And like Sandra, I also want to make this disclaimer. I'm not a terrorist, expert or a security
You're
analyst.
Not a terrorist either.
I'm not a terrorist either. it's one of those things that I think we have to really be careful. There's so much that we don't know,
right,
more than we know about the attacks. I know right after like the evening of, ISIS already claimed that this was something from them, but we don't know if it was a directed thing or it was inspired or how. There's so many things that we still don't know. And as of yesterday's news or this morning's news, I think there's people pushing for governance and that, I mean, the laws to be passed and things like that. I think those are the things that we still have to work on. It's too many factors to actually link everything together into
one. Right. But it does appear as if the government is sort of pressing ahead with changing the terrorism law, mm-hmm, and there's sort of frenzied negotiation going on between the House and the government now. This is a theme that I think comes up sort of across the broader theme. But at what point is it possible that the sort of cure is worse than the affliction? Because in a lot of cases, and this probably ties us more into solid ground of what we were going to be talking about, which was how does the government address sectarianism? How does the government address agendas that are pluralist and indeed are sort of hostile to the pluralist nature of Indonesia's democratic system? If they're done in a sort of heavy-handed and authoritarian way, what sort of risk does that carry, or what does sort of civil society think about that in Indonesia?
I think what you said about heavy-handed is really in the eyes of the beholder, right? For people who are saying that the other side, meaning the ones actually promoting intolerance, the ones who are actually using hate speech to mobilize people, and that the government hasn't really done anything vis-a-vis them, they're actually happy to see a more involved and a more decisive decisions by the government or government agencies on these things. I give you an example. For example, the Ministry of Religious Affairs issued a list of preachers that they think are good preachers. How do you have good preachers? And so these are the safe preachers, right? And so some people would say, well, because, and then of course the other side are giving a list, these are the popular preachers that didn't make it to the list. Or the other one would say, these people, yes, they didn't make it to the list because they're radicals, right? And so the reading of it, of a very, something that actually have been pushed by some people who are actually trying to protect tolerance, trying to limit the space of intolerant preachers, of whom there are many. But like, what is the government's role on that, right? How do you, what is the parameter that a certain preacher actually should not be under the government roster?
And there's a fine line between that as well, because you then have, and again, it's very difficult to not label the other side, but the other side of the government. But a lot of them also feel that they're victims. So when the list came out from those who were from our perspective, preaching intolerance, and they see themselves as now victims, as marginalized. So they say, see, this is what the government, and that's how they're actually trying to build influence and gather more supporters, is playing victim. So a lot of the radical groups are now actually using democratic tools to say, actually, we're the ones being marginalized. Mm. We're the ones, there's so many, and again, that's why President Jokowi is often seen as anti-Islam. See, because he's trying to shut down. The fact that he, you know, there was a law, you know, the banning of Hizb ut-Tahrir. Mm. You know, that's something that was seen as something, see, you're victimizing Islam. So there's that argument as well. So when they actually use the tools of democracy to argue that they're actually the ones being marginalized, or they're the ones that are being victimized. So you're right. A heavy hand is something that we can't use, because then you have that fine, very, very fine line of who's actually in the right, and who is good and who is bad, and who gets on which list. I think there was also another proposal which doesn't actually put them on a list, but actually a certification process that I think mm-hmm. is not actually putting people on the list, but if you, I think the certification.
Your culture.
Yeah. Yeah, so those who actually have evidence, there's evidence that they preach hate.
Also negative list.
A negative list. But also at the same time, again, I think I'm one of those that actually supports a certification process, but mm-hmm. something that's very accountable and transparent, mm-hmm. meaning that if you actually have a degree or you have some education, educational background to be able to preach about Islam or to be able to preach about any religion in Indonesia, then you need to be certified somewhere, in some way. Because right now what the problem is you find a lot of these quote-unquote ustaz or ulamas that just, you know, because they can recite two verses, they're suddenly, they're not going into big mosques, they're not preaching to a mass crowd, but they're going into neighborhoods, going into what we call ibu-ibu pengajian, you know, the study circles, the community study circles. So those are the ones, because they're not certified or there's no certification process, you know, that becomes a problem, because then they influence the narrative as well.
Well, this is what's good for you know that you invite people on a different opinion, because I'm not into certification of ulamas. I think that's very, very hard, and I mean we can discuss about that later. But I think this is the fine line, right? I mean, where is the state in particularly in religious preaching? And I think, you know, we know that there are many ways of becoming Muslim, and there are many different mazhabs or school of thoughts, right? And you cannot have a complete people within a committee who actually would, you know, be able to say that this is right and that is wrong. This is a kosher, you know, so to speak, a preacher and not. I think that is like, at some point, it has to be civil society who would stop going to those preachers, civil society who actually mobilizing information about certain preachers or certain groups, and try to exclude them in a way that is not in a vigilante mode, but at the same time, just promoting the alternative, right? And I think that is, I know that is easier said than done, because at the same time, we also know that the moderates are always moderates. They're not militant in their movement, right? But at the same time, I think this is the kind of things that people are talking about right now, is speak up. The moderates have to speak up. The moderates have to own this. And sometimes it has to be the civil society and not the government. But I think you're right that you know, the whole heavy-handedness, that's just one example, right? Which I think, you know, when I saw that, I felt that this is something that is a little bit too far. But at the same time, and universities also are doing this now. The rector of Universitas Gajah Mada, for example, a big university in Georgia, some of you may have know, also issued. These are preachers that can preach, who can preach in the mosque of the university. And then you know, there's a big disagreement, there's debates. But, you know, I think it should be the people who come there. Like, people should not come to preachers who already we know preaching hatred, as opposed to, I'm okay with the rector because I think it's his mosque, right? But for the government to issue something, it's a different thing altogether.
But can't sort of civil society organizations, especially when they sort of begin to collaborate with the government, so you have these big Islamic organizations in Indonesia, Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah, which have MOUs with the government now on sort of policing online content, and there's also been scholarship on how the government has sort of activated local sort of like neighborhood elected figures in the airway system. So they're like the lowest level of sort of elected officials in Indonesia. They're not really sort of state officials. They sort of are. Don't they just sort of get subsumed in politics and in sort of like, you know, elite efforts to sort of like fight over over the spoils of power, which is probably what happened in 2016. Isn't it sort of dangerous for the government to be bringing along civil society, or is that the best chance that there is?
But I think it is. A concerted effort is needed. But at the same time, it's like, I think we're also, and I think this is the danger that I think Sandra and I have. You know, we talk about, you know, like I said, it's very dangerous to say about the others, and we keep referring to them as others. And I think that is actually the crux of the problem as well. It's like, because we put them in boxes, and we don't have a dialogue with them. We don't actually...
they being sort of...
For those who are more hardline and extremists and
groups.
And because... You know, having, and with all due respect to Muhammadiyah and Nahdlatul Ulama, and I think, again, they still have a lot of influence at the national level, there's also people starting to, because of, again, partnering with the government, there's like, see, they're just tools, or some people trying to, and within Muhammadiyah, correct me if I'm wrong, Masandra, there are also already splits within Muhammadiyah and within Nahdlatul Ulama. They have splits of those who are thinking more hardline and those who are more of the moderate. So, again, you have to be able to have a concerted effort, not just rely on that Muhammadiyah and Nahdlatul Ulama of government relations, but also see where the groups are actually. And again, there's not just them or, you know, the two groups, hardliners or that. There's also people who join, for example, the mass rallies. You know, they don't actually belong to a box of any sort. They're not hardliners. They don't feel that they're hardliners. They just feel that they're defending Islam.
Right.
And they went for the 212 rallies, the rallies just around the gubernatorial elections in 2017. You know, they went to the rallies because it was a peaceful rally. It was them defending the Quran or them defending Islam. It had nothing to do with politics. And again, they just went, also it was because it was a nice day for a picnic.
Right.
There's that category as well. So it's like, you know, you have to be
and
wary
a lot of
that
people were going.
And yeah, it's like, oh, it's a day off. And people actually took a day off to go to the rallies as well.
Sure.
So it's things that we have to realize that not everybody belongs to this group and that group. And there's people who are actually, no, what we don't want hardline.
Right.
And we're not looking for, you know, because it's very easy for us to say, oh, the hardliners, A, they want the Islamic State, they want Sharia. No, some of them just actually want to be able to practice their religion. They're becoming more pious, but more for personal reasons.
Right.
They're not hardline politically or anything. So those are the ones I think we need to start embracing as well. And I think we need to start addressing them as well.
I think this intersects quite well with your Silas paper, which was just published about intolerance in Indonesia and the sort of the growth of the commodification of public sort of displays of piety and of religious belief. And so the question I think that your paper tries to answer is intolerance rising, and if so, in sort of which ways? And so could you tell us a bit about that?
So I think I was exploring more looking into the everyday life of social relationships, because there's a lot that has been written about politics with a capital P, as well as the act of discrimination that is actually recorded. So, for example, church burning or church closing or the attack to the Ahmadi or the Shia, all of those things get reported, right, and recorded. What we have not seen is the everyday relationship between people, which I argue have shifted somehow to a more exclusionary mode. And things that used to be a community, a communal events become more exclusively Muslim, right? Exclusively Islam. Or I'm not sure about the other, about Catholicism or Christians. I'm looking at it from the perspective of the Islamic, apa namanya, pengikut, followers, from the Muslim perspective. So the point that I'm saying there is that we have seen shift and more and more this more exclusive outlook becomes normalized. And there are so many different factors that actually contribute to that. I was actually mentioning TV, for example. And this is the commodification, right, of how, you know, the life of Muslim on TV. I had an interview with a director who told me that if you present somebody who is can be seen as a Muslim in a, as a character of a TV series, for example, you cannot make them having bad characters. So being Muslim means being good on TV. You cannot have a Pak Haji doing bad things. And the whole black and white of Islam versus non-Islam, and if you are Islam, you mean that you're good. This whole you know, simplification, I guess, of being religious also is also going on. And the normalization is then, you know, picking up and strengthened by and also strengthening political process and political rhetoric. So I was tracing also, if you look at the rhetoric in Jakarta 2012 election and then the presidential election in 2014 and then the Jakarta, again, Jakarta election in 2016, you see a higher notch of language, of othering, of, and in, you know, in 2012, there's already started, right, with between Jokowi and at that time Fauzi Bowo. You've started seeing this, Fauzi Bowo using all of the Islamic parties and all that. And then 2014, we a lot of us know what had happened in that presidential election. Jokowi is being seen as Chinese and not a good Muslim, and all that. All of these things then get fed into the everyday narrative of people. And that's what I'm trying to say, is that politicians seem to forget that things that they say, things that they, the strategy that they take actually means something to the people, and it strengthens people's position on othering. And that's actually really been what's going on, and that's what I'm trying to show with some data of the everyday more exclusionary practices in community. And I think, to me, yes, I'm biased because I'm an anthropologist, I'm more concerned about the everyday reality. And you know, since that paper was published, most people who have read that saying that this is eerily familiar. And so many people in different parts of their life also experience that there is a change in Indonesia to a more exclusionary practice of being Indonesians without us actually realizing that this is going on. And to me, that's more concerning. It's not, I mean, we should be concerned about the effort to NKRI bersyariah and whatnot, right? But it is who we are. I mean, we say Indonesians are, you know, anchored in the whole pluralistic nature, right? But that's changing, I think.
I think just to add on that is, how during the campaigns, you know, what Sandra said, what they say matters. And they sometimes, you know, they brush off really quickly. It's like, oh, no, this is just campaign rhetoric. And one's like, no, they don't realize that what is said during these campaigns and what is said during the election cycle doesn't end at the election cycle. Mm-hmm. It continues, because look at 2016, 2017, the anti-AHOC rhetoric till today has a bearing on a lot of the Chinese Indonesians in Jakarta or throughout Indonesia. There are people who are actually fearing for their lives. They're, and this is another, it opens up another different discussion, which I probably won't put Matt through. But again, that's something that we have to deal with. There are people who are fearing for their lives that are leaving. Not to paint a bleak picture, but again, that's the reality. Mm. And because of rhetorics happening in the election cycles. So yeah, that's, I think, what the politicians tend to forget.
That. Mm. I would love to keep going with this, but we did promise a question and answer. And I think a good question would be, will this sort of work as a political tactic in the future? But I'll leave that to the audience. and unless we have no questions, in which I'll just continue to ask you questions. So. We're going to take questions for about 15 minutes, and yeah, if you could just raise your hand if you have a question, and wait for one of the roving microphones, and please identify yourself, and best questions don't have long preambles. So, Meriden Verhal, the director of the East Asia Program.
Hello, I'm Meriden Verhal, the director of the East Asia Program.
Yeah.
I'm just really interested in finding out, yesterday was 20 years since Suharto fell. And thinking back to where you guys were then and the kind of hopes you had for Indonesia for the future, how has that played out, the hopes and the fears that you saw coming ahead for Indonesia? When you look back, how have they played out?
We'll just take two at a time.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Abelia. I'm actually working somehow with Ibu Ima at Habibie Center. Yeah, I have a very short question. Related to, I think recently Habibie Center has launched the terrorist website, like counterterrorism website, and about the bill of counterterrorism that is currently being discussed in the parliament. How do you think it will help mitigate the future terrorist attack in Indonesia? Thank you.
Reformasi. I think with everything that is going on in the last, say, 2-3 years, this whole focus on intolerance and sectarianism, I think we tend to forget what we have actually accomplished, and I think it's really important that we take note of that. You know, Constitutional Court, all of these institutions, KPK, the Corruption Eradication Committee, you know, decentralization all the way now, for all good and bad, mainly good. I believe in local politics, and I think all the way to Undang-Undang Desa, the village governance. These are all really, really positive results of election. Even presidential election is the result of reformasi, right? And so I think we tend to dismiss the many actually institutional results of the movement only 20 years ago. If you look back, it's not that long ago, but we have really meaningful institutional changes in the country. So I think reformasi promised many things, and all those things were accomplished. Now, we can say, okay, corruption is still massive. 65 is not responded and replied properly. But remember, it was under Jokowi's administration that he actually had a symposium on 65 by the government. That was the first, right? And so it was not nothing. It was not completely done, but that there's a recognition of the importance of actually having a discussion, which I thought needed to be mentioned. There's so many different, so many unanswered promises of reformasi, and I think that's what we all, civil society, trying to work on. This is very quickly, however, you know, we need to also, a lot of the civil society organizations and individuals who were really active behind the reformasi era, then get into politics, or the organizations get into the nitty-gritty of governance. So, for example, on budget, right? On the environment groups get into the social forestry, and so on and so forth. I can mention a few. But the point is that they work then into the technocratic part of democracy, right? Which is important. And this is leaving the space open for the anti-democratic voices, if you like, that fills the public space. And that's then where we are right now. But I think in terms of the promises of Reformasi, we could check a lot of boxes.
So I'm going to do a bit of a twofer, try to answer both at once. Reformasi, again, yeah, like Sandra said, I think there's a lot of good that's happened that we often, you know, kind of brush aside. It's like, and we focus on the bad, and that's just kind of because of the news cycles and some of the conversations that happen. But which segues into the question by Abilia, and I promise she was not a plant. I didn't put her to promote what we're doing. But again, because she asked about the terrorism mm-hmm. bill, the fact that we can discuss the bill openly in the media, that's a big significant change. That we know exactly the little nitty-gritty that is actually being debated on the bill, that's a departure from what we had before Reformasi. Right now, to answer her question, is yeah, people are still stuck on definition. I haven't checked it this morning, but the last I checked, they were still stuck on the definition and the role of the military in countering terrorism and how far they can go, again on ideology and on things like that. So what we're doing at the Habibie Center, shameless promotion, is trying to monitor that. We're monitoring where it's happening, what's trend, which groups are involved in what. And again, we're working very closely as well with the NPT, with the terrorism task force, with the members of parliament on some of the input that we can provide. And through the portal, which is called Detexi, we can then actually map things as well. So in terms of, again, the promises of Reformasi, whether or not everything has been checked, as Sandra said, maybe not. But look where we are now. We can actually discuss this. And again, yes, there's a lot of corruption now, maybe even more than before. But the fact that we've reported on them, that actually they're out in the open, and also some of them really completely shameless, is I think, progress. And one thing that I think we didn't touch upon, which I think is very important as well, because when we talked about the ulama, is again the role of media and social media and how that's just all the conversations have just come out in the open through the open media and through social media. And that's kind of where civil society is really now playing a role in ensuring that conversations that are happening in social media, whether Facebook, Twitter, whatever, or even the closed conversations within WhatsApp groups and things like that, that does really play a role, and which makes us, which has a cause for concern for us to look at where that is actually, whether they're contributing, whether civil society is making an impact in trying to educate people to counter hate messages and to counter, to prevent these conversations from escalating into violence. And I think that's really important. I think that needs to be mentioned.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm just a student at University of Sydney. I'd just like to ask, to what extent do you think that personality politics in Indonesia is a direct result of the lack of real change implemented by leaders?
Thank you. Hi, Cassandra. Hi, Kaina. Apa kabar? My name is Nova, and I'm new in Sydney. This is my second one. I'm studying at Macquarie Graduate School of Management at the moment. And then it is true what you say, that things are changed. But in my personal opinion, the roots of intolerance, it was there since a long time ago. Mm-hmm. For example, 6 years ago, I was in Panyabungan. It is a remote area, 19 hours driving from West Sumatra. I was with my Australian volunteer, helping her to settle. She worked with a local NGO there as a GIS officer. It was very struggling for us to find a house for her, because no one wants to rent a house for her, because she is foreign people, and all the villagers think that, oh, she's kafir, she's not Muslim. And then finally we found someone that willing to rent her house. And then we want to find a bed, like a kitchen and everything that to support her life there. And 3 or 4 shop reject me and her to buy things from their shop just because she's kafir. This is really hurt my feeling because just 19 hours from that area, it is West Sumatra, well, where people in my hometown lives, democratic lives happily. We have Chinese, we have Indians, we have full tolerance. And then this area is just very secluded. And there is an Islam dormitory school there with 3,000 students and 5 students living in a 5-square-meter house together. They live together there. No electricity. And they woke up at 4 o'clock and then go to the school. And then how do we know what the ustad teach them on a daily basis? Because the people surround that school almost having the same thought. Like, other than Islam, they all kafir. Even me, because I'm not wearing hijab. That's what's happened in remote area. Back then, in Jakarta, the capital city of Indonesia, my neighbor, she's wearing big hijab with a niqab. We have same gate in our house. I always open the gate for her. For her, I never exist. I smile at her. I talk to her. I greet her. But I never exist. Didn't even look at me once. That's in the centers of Indonesia. It's just heartbreaking. And then I start my little advocacy to my mom because my mom is in the community circles of pengajian. I said to my mom, if your ustad start to speak hate in your mosque, go out. Bring your friends out because our religion doesn't teach us to do that. Like killing people, not okay. My mom start, and few of her friends follow her, step out of the mosque, and then in my community now, people hate my mom because you think, oh, my mom have a thought like that because I got a scholarship from a kafir. So that's why my mom says, okay, hate speech not all right. Like my mom respect other people. That's wrong because my mom has a daughter that go to Sydney and fully funded by kafir.
Mashallah.
Yeah. Then my mom, before Ramadan, this is an idea from my mom. My mom said, can you talk to your friend? Can we make the ustad that speak in the mosque certified, like fully training by the government? They have their license, so we can detect them, what they speak, what they teach their umat. Like a teacher in Indonesia, we have certification. Is it possible to do that for our ustad? Thank you.
Well, we do get to return to the point of disagreement here. So anyways, all right, so the certification question and then the personalized politics question.
So first thing on the certification, I think I'll address that and I'll get back to you, I promise. Here's the thing, right? I mean, I guess I'm more of I don't believe that we can do that. And that's why I bring in the whole issue of civil society, which is a point that you made that I didn't address, which is whether civil society is being subsumed by the government and actually they become, you know, part of the government.
Yeah, or just politics.
Right, which is I think not necessarily true. Thought not necessarily really true, but you know, it has to be a concerted effort, as Ima said. But the thing with the certification of the ulama, I think it is exact. Right now, there are many different initiatives that are actually being done by civil society to report those people, right? And so let them be reported, and then actions being taken by them. To them, by the government, right? And so if they say, you can slaughter the Chinese, okay, that is wrong, that's hate speech. And we have actually regulations against hate speech that is actually more tight than, for example, it is in the United States. So I know that it's so hard for them to actually get people who are actually saying those things. But the point here is that it has to be, they have to say it, it has to be reported, and then it has to be processed, as opposed to silencing people, right? And that's actually what's going on right now, is the silencing of people. Yes, they are, they do have track records of saying intolerance issues, but it cannot be the civil society being a vigilante, right? Of saying this is what you should say and this is what you should not be saying, because where is going to be the limit of that? And some of these people are really our friends, right? I mean, the Banser of NU and all that, they are our part of, you know, community. But I disagree with this heavy-handed civil, relying on civil society, and this is part of the criticism to the government, is that you have to do that. It could not be civil society, because it will create chaos. Who is actually going to be, who is actually going to be, where's the parameters? Antara and between NU and Muhammadiyah, I mean, there are differences of looking at things, right? Belum, I mean, not to mention Persis and all that. There are many ways, there are many understanding of being is Muslim. And you can't just have one. And certification, I'm afraid, will have a monolithic truth of what is it that you can or cannot say. And for me, Islam is not about that. Islam is about trying to find out things, ijtihad, you know, all of these things are very important, and it can change. But, you know, with certification, once it's certified, then it's very dangerous. For teachers, it's different, right? But we can get into that later. But, about the personality in politics, and is it because of you know, the weakest link in Indonesia reformasi is political parties, right? That is the weakest link. And that has allowed the personality politics to become, you know, the most important thing, right? And, you know, and I think that is, you know, a majoritarian democracy has that effect on voters, right? It's not just in Indonesia. I think that's everywhere around the world. Your country, more than anything else, I think, is an exemplary case.
So often I get verbaled as American, you know?
So that's, you know, I think you're right. And that actually refers more to a political party. The weakness of the Reformasi project is more accountable, stronger civil political parties that actually have good program, agenda, ideology. And this is also confusing. And with all local elections that are actually going on in Indonesia, it becomes even more confusing, because political parties that are making alliance in one area can be fighting in an area just next door. You know, and so what is the position of a political party when, you know, a Gerindra PDI coalition in somewhere, and then on a national level they're always fighting? Yeah. So then people are so confused about what are these political parties' positions on actually. And then the personal politics become important.
Well, with that, I have to regretfully bring this to a close. Thank you for those questions, and thank you for joining us today. I really want to thank the Australia-Indonesia Institute, which, as I mentioned, made Ima and Sandra's visit possible. And in connection with the Australia-Indonesia Institute, we have a board member of the AII here today, which is Lydia Santoso, who, among other things, is a board member of the AII, as well as a lawyer focused on Indonesian Australian law and evaluates new Colombo plan applications for Indonesia. So I'd just like to invite Lydia to say a few words just to bring us to a close today. Thanks, Lydia.
Thank you, Matthew. Good afternoon, everybody. It's lovely to see some familiar faces, including my high school Bahasa Indonesian teacher in the audience here. On behalf of the, before I formally thank the speakers, I just wanted to share with you some interesting facts or information about the Institute. We are so proud today to be supporting this event. As Matthew had mentioned earlier, this was a result of a grant application on behalf of the Lowy Institute to the AII, and one that we are very happy to support. And what a way to kick off these series of events, given the timing and the recent events that have happened in Indonesia. So I think it's we've had a very frank, open, and interesting discussion today about, you know, topics that before reformasi, you know, were taboo. So I think back to your question, I think that's a huge progress that Indonesia has made. But the Institute was established in 1989 on behalf of the Australian government, and we run programs, and some of the programs you might be aware of include the Australia-Indonesia Youth Exchange Program, the Muslim Exchange Program, which is exceptionally important in this day and age. We do the bridge school programs, and we also do the grant application. So if any one of you here are from an organization or are working on a project who are needing some funds, I strongly suggest that you look at our website and make an application for a grant. But I just wanted to say a warm thank you to Ibu Ima and to Ibu Sandra for coming today, and also to the Lowy Institute for orchestrating this event. I think it is important to discuss these matters in the open and to get some frank and an open discussion about them. I've actually just returned from an AII board meeting, which we were in Surabaya the week of the attacks and then to Jakarta. So it was an interesting time, and we visited NU and Muhammadiyah in our trip to Surabaya, and in Jakarta we were lucky enough to visit the vice president. So the dialogue between Australia and Indonesia are happening, and the relationship is, you know, strengthening. And also with the current negotiations about the AIASEPA, I think that's going to show and bring some more dimensions to the relationship if we ever finalise the agreements. But Ibu Ima, Ibu Sandra, on behalf of the Institute, and also I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of Lowy Institute as well, thank you so much for coming. I wish you all the best in the tour. I hope it's not too grilling of an itinerary for you, but I look forward to hearing about the discussions that will come out in Canberra, for example, in particular, and in Melbourne. So all the best, and thank you very much for attending today.